Access number 31400, rule 2.
Yes, I know, sir. So you're doing the trials and was it just basically training program over that period of time?
Yeah, it was a lot of training to do with Iraq, you know, suicide bombers, IEDs, vehicle checkpoint drills, dolphin checkpoint drills.
What's a dolphin checkpoint?
Dolphin VCPs, where you're on the water and you're doing boat patrols. You know, and I remember in Iraq, you'd go out, if they saw a boat they didn't like the look of, you'd flag it down, you'd board, search it.
So where did you do your training for that then?
We went all over the UK. We went Salisbury Plain, went to Carwent in Wales, Brecon. I think we even went down to Lydd, I can't remember. We've done some training in Pirbright. Just waiting to go out on Telex 6.
So, how long of a preparation period did you have, you know, from the time that you heard you were going to Iraq?
About a year.
So you had quite a long time to do all of this, did you?
Yeah.
Was there emphasis, you mentioned some of the things, but was there emphasis on sort of more sort of weapons training, that sort of thing, or did that remain the same and you did these extra bits?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it remained the same, you'd do more, but you'd do more of it, so you'd do more stuff which would be irrelevant. You'd do more drills around battalion and around in Wales on vehicle checkpoints. You'd do maybe a bit of languages, like learning to speak Arabic.
To what level?
Being able to stop people on a checkpoint, ask them to step out of the car, open their boot, ask them for ID.
Were you given any sort of training on how to behave? Obviously, we're dealing with the local population.
Yeah, because at that point, it all come out about the Americans stringing up the people in a breadbasket, and the same as the Fusiliers, what they did in Iraq. So, going out then, doing the whole hearts and minds was critical. You know, if a kid come up to you and, you know, hit you, if you're in back, you know, you're sure someone would see it, it'd be in the news before you know it. You'd have a shitstorm in the British media.
So you were getting lectured on this, how to behave, what to do, what your role is. You're getting
good preparation. You'd get prepped on that. You'd also get prepped on, you'd get briefed on rules of engagement.
What were they for Iraq?
They were Card Alpha. If you'd been contacted by insurgents and they were firing at you, you could return fire. But the moment they turn their backs and go, because they're not posing a threat to you, even though they are, but they're not, you can't do nothing. Your hands are tied.
So that's quite restrictive, is it, to what you can actually do if you came under attack?
Yeah, it can be frustrating. It can wind you up. But, you know, again, you deal with it. You just get on with it.
Were you issued with any new kit for that period when you were going to go out?
Got issued a whole new set of desert kit. We didn't have no deserts in the battalion, so we got issued assault vests, boots, trousers, camel pack.
What's the camel pack?
Water hydration system.
How does that work?
It's basically a water bottle, but it's like a 1.5-2 litre pack which you put on your back. You can put it in your day sack. It's got an extendable hose. And if you put cold water in it, it keeps it quite cold for a certain amount of time. Where it's more convenient to get instead of going through your kit whilst on patrol or, you know, on a vehicle patrol. You can just unclip your drinking tube and just drink from it, do a lid back up.
And the body armour you were given, what type of body armour was that one?
It was standard. At the time, it wasn't Osprey. It was like a jacket. You know, Velcro jacket you put on it. Obviously, it had two plates. One protecting your heart, and one protecting your back. But they were quite small plates.
Did it allow for freedom of movement?
It did. Until when we was out in Iraq, we got asked to trial some new body armour, which you couldn't move in at all.
Well, what was the difference with that then?
You'd put it on over your head. But it had sleeves, like a t-shirt, but it was quite thick, and it had a massive nape, so you couldn't really move your head. It had the same plates in, but again, you couldn't hold your weapon properly, so we stopped using it and just used the normal body armour.
Were you issued at all for Iraq with the? Did you have a camera on your helmet at all at that stage? Was that one of the things that?
No, I had I had an LLM, a laser light module.
What does that do?
Yeah, it goes on your rifle, and you get on your handguard. You get a pressel. So if you want a red dot laser, you can press it, and you can look if you're on a target, for instance, where that laser's pointing. You can shoot, and it hit, providing it was zero to you. Or you'd have another one for a light, so you can go into a house on search and arrest op, and check if it's dark. Or you can have, if you've got a your night vision, you can have an infrared one, so you can see without obviously giving your position away.
And you got issue with that prior to going, did you?
Yeah, but we got it out of theatre. Again, you'd be allocated it, it'd go out to theatre, you'd go out and pick it up the other end with your weapons.
Did you have a chance to train with it before you went?
Yeah, we used it prior to going. You know, you'd change your handguards, put it on your weapon, you'd every opportunity you'd get used to using it. It was no different really to just weigh a bit more on your weapon, but it was quite a handy piece of kit.
How did you get out to Iraq?
I went from here to Bryce Norton. Got on a plane. I don't know what it was. I'm trying to think then. It wasn't a Herc. Got on a plane, went straight out to the APOD in Basra. Got a coach under military escort from there down to Sharba Logistics Base, where we went, where we'd done a couple of days to get used to the environment and the heat.
I was going to say, with that, you mentioned obviously the camel. Did you, at that stage, had you been given any sort of lectures on, you know, dehydration, the effects of, like, loss of water, you know?
Yeah, so drink four.
I take it you haven't been to that environment before.
No. Drink four bottles a day. Try and stay hydrated. Obviously, try and eat as well. But more importantly, try and keep yourself hydrated. If you feel yourself a bit funny, getting shade and... You know, just basically if you look after yourself, and if you see others with the same effects, sort yourself out and do it.
And at that stage, you've been told obviously other kind of protection against the sun. Did you have to wear a hat all the time?
Yeah, you got a jungle hat, desert jungle hat, which helped sort of. You get given sun cream, insect repellent, and if you was hot. Or if you're burning on your arms, then put your sleeve down and just take on water.
And you had a couple of days there, did you, before you went out and did anything to acclimatise?
You had a couple of days to acclimatise, but then the other companies went out to Azerbaijan and Al-4, because we were a strike company, search and rest ops mainly. We stayed in Sharba Logistics Base, waiting to go out.
So what was the area that the battalion was covering in Iraq?
Basra South AO, which was Azerbaijan, which was a few miles up the road from Sharba, Al-4, which was down by Qusar, and Basra Palace, which was in Basra City Central.
And was each company allocated a specific area that they would do for the whole tour, or would you rotate?
No, we stayed there for the whole tour. Well, they stayed there for the whole tour, whole 6 months.
And with your role, obviously, within C Company, you said you were the strike company.
Yeah.
Can you explain to me what that entails?
Yeah, if there was no insurgents in Basra, and they'd been watching them for... Or they had intel on insurgents operating around the area, and they had an address, we'd go and break into their house, arrest them, search them. And we'd done really well. We had some successful operations.
Can you take me through sort of a typical operation, what you would do at that
stage? Yeah, we got sent out to one search and rest stop. Remember, when we got launched, we had three teams for our platoon, and that'd be the team I was in. I'd go through the back door. There'd be another team who'd follow up behind you, and probably one team around the front. and you'd have other platoons doing out call, and then you'd have the search platoon or the search team. So we went up to the building hard and fast, out the back of the snatches. Blokes would carry the ladders on the back wall, jump over the wall, kick the back door in. We'd go in, and by that time they'd probably be arrested, or they would have got out, but got arrested outside. Cordon off the area, and then the search team would come in and search for any IEDs, weapons, mobile devices, mobile phones, laptops. And if you found anything, you'd leave it kept on.
When you were entering the place, you mentioned obviously carrying ladders. Did you have any other equipment to sort of get through a door if you couldn't kick in?
Yeah. I'm trying to think, did we? Yeah, you would. I'm sure you would. You'd have like a lot of the police use. You'd smash the door in.
Like a little battery, it's a battery.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
But, you know, 9 out of 10 times you wouldn't need it because the doors are quite flimsy. You'd just boot them in.
It's sort of the typical places you go to. Are they like small compounds that surround the houses most of the time, or is it just a house?
Some of them are like normal houses with big back gardens, and some of them will be, you know, little huts or whatever, but most of them are mainly in like housing districts.
And where would you get your information from? Would you be briefed as well on the operation as to who you were looking for?
Yeah,
what you had,
just go into detail of who they, what they look like. You'd be shown air faults, shown possible, you know, your routes in, and you'd rehearse that prior to going. You'd rehearse getting out of the vehicles and going up to the wall, getting ready to go in and lock it down.
And with that, were you looking at sort of doing it within a kind of specific time if you could? From the point of exit from the Land Rover to getting in there and getting them, if you could.
I think it's still prior to arresting a terrorist or insurgent. I think it's still 8 or 12 hours you've got, so you've got to move fast. You've got to get in and out, you know, while searching thoroughly to be able to get them back to for interrogation and to see if you can charge them with anything. Because the longer you take, the more time they're going to just sit there, sitting pretty before they're released.
And are they handed over to the Iraqis at the point when they're arrested, or does it still stay with the British military?
It depends. I think nearer the Brumaries out there, I think they tended to hand the case over to the Iraqi government. I think because it was their country, they wanted them to get used to dealing with things their way. So that's what tends to sort of really go on. But it's, you know, it depends. I mean, we didn't do, I think for like 2.5 months we'd done nothing. We'd go out on patrols, but we had no search and arrest stops. Then we got more and more. They just become frequent.
Is the battalion building up its intelligence as well during that period of who the sort of?
Yeah, you'd have O groups, and they say, right, information from L4 is that there's, you know, so and so, there's intelligence coming down from L4 or whatever, you know, or there's. There's been people seen dicking in as a buyer, or just around, or there's been like bombs in Baghdad, and people have heard that they're going to bring insurgents down to Basra, and you know, and you always get daily in briefs, you know, more or less as soon as they know, you know, sort of thing, to keep you in the loop.
And obviously when you go into a house and you're arresting them, what do you have anything to secure them with? On you?
Yeah, plastic cuffs.
And is that, would you, if you went into house, would you cuff everybody for that at the moment, or just you identify who you
No, you don't identify your alpha. And then arrest them. From then on, they'd go into the back of the snatch.
In the cases when you were doing it, would they ever offer resistance to you?
Some of them. But you do what you're trained to do in order to, you know, successfully arrest them within the guidelines of British military law and prisoner handling.
And those are?
Well, you know, there's no wrongful doing if you go in and assault someone. You know, you give someone under, you know, you're interrogating someone, say, under duress, let's go against the Geneva Convention, you can't put them in stress positions, you can't give them water, you know, you can't not give them water. You know, you've got to, you know, treat them how you'd wish to be treated. So, you know, you'd have to be careful in some ways, because if you said, like, you know, shut up, I can, you know, just give him a bit of a, you know, a bit of lip or give him a slap, it'd come out in the end. So you'd arrest them, they'd try talking to you, you'd ignore them. You know, you'd have no contact with them. You'd just tell them that they're under arrest, or tell the interpreter to tell them they're under arrest. You know, and they can make their phone call once they get to the isolation facility.
And do they try and engage in conversation almost? So you might say something, or you might be revolt.
To be honest, I wouldn't know. I've never seen that. I've just, you know, I'm just going off what I've been taught and what I've been shown. You know, some of them do try, you know, especially in Afghanistan, you see them trying to talk to you, and you're not interested, because, you know, the Taliban, you know what they are. They say they're not, but, you know, they blatantly are. They've got chest rigs on and everything, so, you know, they try and pull the wool over your eyes. You're just doing your job. You know, the sooner you get them, you know, plastic cuffed and, you know, bagged and tagged as it is, the sooner they get off to Bastion ready for interrogation.
And obviously within, you know, a lot of the Iraqi homes that you're going into, do they usually have a weapon?
It depends. They, obviously, everyone out in them countries are allowed to have a weapon for the safety of their family and their land. But whether they use it or not is another thing. They might have it in a cupboard.
So if you sort of, you know, when you went into the, on the kind of search things, if you see a weapon in a cupboard, is that, say it's a single, you know...
You'd still bag and tag it, because whether it's licensed to them, I'm not saying it has to be licensed, but you never know. It could be used. It could have been used for anything.
But that wouldn't be an unusual thing to come across, would it, say, the single...
Probably not. The majority of Afghanis and Iraqis would have AKs. You know, if they've got a massive stockpile, then you start asking questions, but, you know, majority of them did have them, because that's what they did.
And at the other time, you were doing patrolling, I take it. Were you doing foot patrols or vehicle patrols?
Both.
With the foot patrols, I mean, what kind of form do they take? Is it a staggered patrol?
Staggered round. I say as a buyer, you go in as a buyer, and you'd be on something like maybe a 6 or 8 hour patrol. You're walking down all the back alleys, all the streets, you know, you're engaging with locals, you know, under soft posture as well. You know, bury your soft app, and, you know, and you're saying hello to people, you know, shaking their hands, or, you know, whatever, just trying to be nice to them. And never really got any trouble. You know, I remember someone tried to nick something at me, side patch, and I pushed him away and told him to get lost, and his dad come over. And I remember my team commander coming over and saying, what's happened here? I said, he tried to nick my night sight out of my pocket. It was in my pouch. And he said, you know, the interpreter said to him, tell his dad what he did. And I remember he told him, and he slapped his son around the head and pulled him in by his ear, like. So, you know, they do try it. You know, they'll ask for chocolate and sweets, and you go, yeah, I'll have them. You know, I don't want them.
Is that mainly the kids, or who will follow you around when you're doing that?
Kids or adults that ask you for money or whatever, and, you know, you just, you know, salam, salam.
So you smile and wave?
Yeah, it's half the time you look at everything, I don't know what you're saying. I'm just smiling just because, to be polite. And that's it, you know, unless you could engage in a conversation, or you get some of them who say, you know, I'm really hard, yeah, well done. You know, you get seen doing that, you know, putting your fists up, you're going to get fucking, you're going to be hanged, you are.
What impression did you kind of gain among the Iraqi people?
They wanted us there. It was, well, compared to Afghanistan, they definitely wanted us there. And they was happy to see us, you know, I'm not saying all Afghans didn't want us there, because some of them did. But compared to Afghanistan, where you'd go through Sangin and get the Sangin deaths there, which is horrible, when you know a whole town just stops to look at you and are probably thinking that they wish you're dead. You know, it's not a nice thought. It plays with your mind. You think, fucking, I've got to come back this way. You know, whether they're for or against the Taliban, or the same as Iraqis, whether they're for or against insurgents, you don't know.
But the Iraqis, it was a different kind of feel, was it? An atmosphere that you had down there, would you say?
Yeah, a lot of them were, you know, they'd welcome you being there because you're keeping insurgents out of their towns and whatever.
Vehicle patrols, what was the setup with those? Where would you go on those? Would it be through
around,
the town?
Around Basra, you'd go everywhere. Down the motorways, you wouldn't let no vehicles come into your convoy. If a vehicle would come too close and you told it to stop, you'd get on the radio and ask to fire a warning shot. Obviously, if you fire a warning shot, not saying we did, but if you did fire a warning shot and they fouled, that didn't stop them, you're then allowed under the rules of engagement to fire a shot at them. You know, whether that be through their windscreen, just to make them get the message, or a shot at them, you'd have to do it. You know if they're a suicide bomber, you don't know.
But you're not going to take that chance, are you, with them?
Well, no, I mean, a few times, you know, I was at the rear of the convoy and you turn them to stop, you pin up your left hand. Wrong. Yep, you pin up your left or right hand. And they're still coming, and you tell them again. If they get too close, majority of the time, you point your weapon at them and, you know, physically tell them to stop. You know, you shout it. Not so they can hear you, but they get the message when they've got a SA-80 pointing in their grid. You know, they soon slow down and you tend to keep off. So, you know, it's majority of the time, it's you just do what you've got to do.
What vehicles are you using for this?
Snatch 2.
What was your opinion of the Snatch 2?
I hated them. They're too top heavy. Knew you used to like them.
How many people would you normally have on a routine patrol?
Probably between 6 and 8. You could have 4 sitting in the back, 2 standing, 2 in the front.
And would you take turns with the
top cover? Yeah. Yeah, you would. You mainly more or less be top cover because you'd have to get out and do your 5 and 20s. It'd be boring after a while. But obviously, that there for a reason as well. But yeah, you'd change around and everything else.
And obviously, when you're sort of in the snatch, are you keeping an eye out for IEDs at the side of the road, anything like that, anything that?
Yeah, anything suspicious. If you're suspicious, you just get on the radio and say, stop, stop, stop. They'll stop. Why have you stopped? Oh, there's a dead dog down there. You know. Right. Okay. Well, if it looks suspicious, we'll flag it up. Cordon.
And what would they usually do? Would you be looking for things that were suspicious at the side of the road, on the road?
Yeah, anything. If presence of the normal. Wrong. Absence of the normal, presence of the abnormal. You know, you'd go through it where if you're going down a street and you know it was really busy that day and you go down there and it's not, then, you know, your combat indicator's thinking, well, why is this? So, you know, it's just go through your drills, your skills and drills you learn. If things don't add up, but you wouldn't go down the same route all the time, you'd always change your route every time. So,
and in that period, obviously we're not moving from the same place, did you get a real feel for the area, the areas that you needed to avoid, which ones were?
Yeah, you get used to them, like you were told to start away the sheer flats. It's just a rough area. So that was a red zone. Couldn't go in there. And that was on the way to Basra, so you'd only stick to the green zones. You know, where you know they're safe to a certain extent.
Were there any incidents that occurred with either, you know, I mean, you mentioned with foot patrols nothing really happened. Was there anything that occurred during the vehicle patrols that you were doing?
Vehicle rolled. I was on R&R. Vehicle rolled after a search and rest stop. It was in the paper that a clerk, funnily enough, said that she disarmed an insurgent who had one of her rifles with 2 of her British soldiers knocked out, which I don't believe for a minute, but, you know, that's what she said.
Oh, so he'd been in the vehicle when it rolled, had he?
Yeah, apparently there was 4 people in there, a prisoner, a clerk and 2 soldiers from One Mile Angling. The vehicle had rolled and she disarmed him. He managed to get a SA-80. She disarmed him. I don't see it personally, but, you know, that's what she says. You know, she was in the paper and on the news, but
And you were on R&R at the time, were you?
Yeah, I was back in the UK.
So, during the tour, how many opportunities did you get back? Was it just the once, or...?
Yeah, once or 2 weeks.
Is that a bit strange coming back from sort of that environment, then coming back for 2 weeks and then being back again?
Yeah, it's hub.
Sorry, it's it is quite weird. You think to yourself, you know, 2 weeks, that's not a long time. And you go back out, but it's good to get away from, you know, everything, just chill out.
Did you find it a bit strange, obviously, with, you know, returning to sort of the UK and the kind of civilian world's understanding of the situation being different from what you were experiencing on the ground?
Civilians don't care, to be honest, in my personal view, they don't care. As long as they don't interfere in their perfect little lives, they're not interested. So, you know, it sounds arrogant, but I don't really care about them because they've got no time for us. No one has. You know, the only time they really care is when, you know, someone dies. I don't care any other time because it's messing up their perfect little lives. So, you know, civilian side of things, yeah, it comes across I don't like them, but, you know, truth is I don't, because, like I said, they've... I can understand where they're coming from, because they're so used to their set ways and their lives. You know, British soldiers killed, oh, well, yeah, you know, it's terrible, isn't it? Where for us, you know, a lot of people have no idea what we're doing and how we deal with things and what we have to do, what we go through on a daily basis. So...
The end of the tour, how did that come to? Were you back to the UK?
Yeah, it was quiet. Come home. Had 6 weeks off. And then I was back in work in. Well, I had a car crash actually when I come back. So I got hit by a drink driver and I smashed my shoulder.
Where was that then?
Back in Basin. I just met my girlfriend who I'm actually getting married to in March actually, but. You know, was coming home from going out, got hit by a drink driver. So I was off work about a week and a half before we were all due to go and leave anyway. That's 6 weeks off or 7 weeks. Come back to work at the end of January 2006. And just carried on.
And at that stage, was that when you were hearing that you might be off to Afghanistan? Did you get the same kind of preparation time that you'd had?
No, we had about 8 months. About 6 to 8 months, we had preparation for Afghanistan. When we were told we were going to Afghanistan, I thought, well, we're going back to Kabul. You know, I had no idea. We'd had troops in southern Afghanistan. So... You know, it's a bit of a shock. So, yeah, you go to Helmand. Well, where's Helmand? Southern Afghanistan. Oh, right, okay. And obviously, we got started getting briefed by Parachute Reg.
Had you seen any art footage that had been on the TV that they'd shot themselves on the.
On the mobiles? I've seen some of it, and I thought, you know, it's Afghanistan. Where's that? You know, I had no idea. You know, it was kept quite quiet, actually. And then obviously it came out on the news about the powers being in Afghanistan, and then I thought that's when it sort of really came to light that we was back in Afghanistan, you know, fighting the Taliban. But now we got briefed by the CO, you know, Colonel Carver, who said, you know, yeah, we're going out on Operation Herrick 6, taken over from Royal Marines. Royal Marines? And that wasn't... Paris Marines.
Was the Marines, wasn't it?
It was Marines, yeah. It was six power. God's sake, Ian. It was two. Was it no? Wrong. It was three power. It was out there first of all on Herrick 4. Royal Marines. I think it was 4-2 Commando 4-5.
And they'd come in to talk to you a little bit about what was going on, had they?
Yeah, OPTAG. We went and done our OPTAG training. You know, we to get given the green light to go on operations. We went to, you know, we went to Kenya. We went to Thetford and done all sorts of training, you know, from protecting a fob to, you know, full-on contacts. And, you know, I remember us all talking about it, you know, this ain't going to happen to us. We're going to have a really shit tour, excuse my language, but we're going to have a really crap tour. it's going to be the same, you know, it's always good for the powers and that, it's always rubbish for us.
So you were you expecting almost the trouble to kind of die out by the time?
Yeah, I had no idea, it'd explode into all it did, and it was an absolute eye-opener, it was amazing.